Highways Voices, the podcast of Highways News, your one-stop destination for all the news about the highways and transport technology industries, and our must-read daily newsletter.
This week on Highways Voices, we chat to a former transport secretary.
As a minister, you are surrounded by people saying, do this, do that, do the other. Most of the time, you can't possibly entertain what's being proposed. Sometimes you get a gem of a good idea. One of the myths around Westminster is that we are surrounded by big businesses who have got a sort of evil, insidious influence on government. Actually, the charitable sector, the NGO sector, are just as, if not more powerful than the commercial sector in lobbying government.
Our guest is Chris Grayling, who talks about juggling different transport policy requirements, smart motorways, safety and public opinion, as well as influencing government policy and the elephant in the room of road user charging. It's a fascinating insight into the wheels of government on this week's Highways Voices.
Highways Voices, in association with partner organisations ELCRIG, ADEPT, the Transport Technology Forum and ITS UK.
So Chris Grayling's come shortly, but beforehand, let's pick up on some of the headlines you can read on our Highways News website. Now, Adrian's away today, so you're stuck with me to pick out what's interesting online, and I'll start with the AA President Edmund King believing that vehicle excise duty should be used to create a national protected fund that can be used to pay for future road improvements, such as the repair of potholes. He told the Daily Telegraph, you need all the money to be ring-fenced, so it is spent on maintenance. In the newspaper report that blames Neville Chamberlain for the state of our roads for abolishing the ring fencing of VED for roads back in 1937. The UK startup Wave Technologies has received a $1 billion funding boost. Southbank Group led the investment round, which included money from Microsoft and Nvidia. Wave wants car makers and other fleet operators to install its technology into their vehicles rather than own and operate the cars themselves. A charity for blind people has called for so-called floating bus stops to be banned. NFB UK calls the junctions chaotic and downright dangerous, adding that the configuration puts visually impaired people at particular risk, with boarding islands shown to be too narrow for users of mobility canes when stepping off buses. Check out the video they posted via the story on our website. And the agenda for Highways UK has been published. The industry event brings together the people responsible for planning, developing, managing, maintaining and future-proofing the nation's road network. Returning to the NEC in Birmingham on the 16th and 17th of October. Yours truly will be hosting the keynote session again with some of the biggest names in our industry. You can see all that's going on, and there's a lot via the link on our site. And don't forget, it's the place where you can sign up for our daily email into your inbox every lunchtime if you subscribe at highways-news.com.
Highways Voices, the podcast from highwaysnews.com. Highwaysnews.com.
So what's it really like to be the Secretary of State for Transport? How much power do you really have? Well, our guest on this week's Highways Voices can tell us, because he did the job for many years. Chris Grayling is MP for Epsom and Yule and attended an ITS UK Enforcement Forum meeting last week at the Atkins Realis offices in Epsom, and I got to interview him in front of the audience and record the chat for you. We started by asking if he had any experience of the industry before he took over the Transport Secretary role.
Yes, but not in journalism. So I started at the BBC, worked in BBC Television News. I then went to Channel 4 and worked on the Channel 4 Business Daily programme, at lunchtime half-hour business programme. And then went back to BBC Enterprises for a while. But somebody once said to me, there's only two jobs in television, front the show or own the station. Likely he wasn't going to front the show. So I moved off into the commercial side of the media. And I both ran a couple of small production businesses and then moved into the consulting world, focusing on change communication. And a number of my clients were transport businesses. I worked for Britannia Airways, for Thompson's when they were the travel firm, for Visteon, which was an offshoot of Ford that sadly didn't last forever, and various other things. So I'd had some grounding in transport before I started in Parliament. And then when I did start in Parliament, I was on the Select Committee for a while. So I didn't come to the job, and I was also Shadow Transport Secretary. So I didn't come to the transport role without any knowledge of it. I mean, I'm not a specialist in the way lots of people are, but it was relatively familiar territory.
My first ever flight was with Britannia Airways.
Absolutely. So
I think like most people.
Back.
Yeah, absolutely. And so how much of your day-to-day work was roads? How much was rail? How much was aviation? How did you juggle such a wide array of things to worry about?
So it is a juggling exercise. I mean, it is not for no reason that people in the transport world jokingly refer to the Department of Transport as the Department for Rail, because rail always seems to be a hassle, despite the fact it was and still is just a privatised industry. Somehow all the problems landed on the Secretary of State's desk. You know, the joys and delights of the 2018 timetable change, where a number of people in the industry, both public and private, totally messed up. Amazingly, all the brown stuff flew in the direction of the Secretary of State, who didn't have anything to do with setting up the new timetable. So rail took a lot of time. Actually, my number one priority as Transport Secretary was getting planning consent for the third runway at Heathrow, which I'd always believed and I still believe is necessary. I'm very frustrated it hasn't happened, because we got it far further down the track than, or you know, along the runway than it ever had before. And then the pandemic came along and it's all rather kind of ground to a halt, which is very frustrating. But I spent a lot of time on roads as well. But what I would say is that the Department of Transport tends to focus on the strategic road network. The number of issues that land on your desk that relate to local roads, and some of the things which you're all working with, is far less. I mean, a lot of your interactions, frankly, are going to be with local authorities and the decisions that they take. What the department does, it puts in place some of the regulatory frameworks that enable you to do the work you're doing with the local authorities. But very often, those are things that arrive on the desk of ministers, not quite as a fait accompli, but where a lot of the work's been done by officials.
And is that actually the right way to do it, in your opinion, given that you can't really open a paper without story after story about potholes? Mm-hmm. And if you've got no real power to force mm-hmm. councils to actually fill in potholes, mm-hmm. then how can that be your fault?
Well, the answer is it can't be, but you get blamed anyway. And it's one of the things about the politics. It's always the minister's fault, whatever happens. It's always the government being incompetent, whatever happens. I mean, if you take the example of potholes, the government's only really involvement in fixing potholes is to provide extra cash to local authorities to fill them. And local authorities may be good or they may be bad at it. And this year is a particularly bad year. I've just, in fact, been speaking to somebody. I was out this morning for the local election campaign, speaking to somebody complaining about the potholes, and said, well, this is a particularly bad year. I mean, there's been so much rain, and because potholes are caused by damp getting into the road surface, it's going to take weeks and weeks and weeks for any local authority to fix it. And of course, there are better means of fixing it. Some local authorities do it well, some don't. I remember going out in Lancashire with the team who fixed potholes there. They had a very nifty piece of kit that both hoovered out potholes, but also sealed them very effectively before filling them, and did so pretty quickly. You actually get to see that kind of thing, but more probably when you are on the road doing visits to local MPs and election campaigns, because they want to find something for the Transport Secretary to do. But the amount of times that actually lands on your desk in Westminster is pretty small, actually.
We're in a ITS UK Enforcement Forum meeting, so obviously road safety is a very important topic. How much was that a priority for you?
So, well, safety is always a priority. It's always important. I think probably the biggest issue when I was Secretary of State, and has continued clearly, was the issue of smart motorways and all lane running. And indeed, after the Grenfell fire, I said to the Highways England, as it was then, team, who were putting together all the smart motorways, say, look, you know, actually, this is a horrendous incident. There'll be lots of who knew what, who should have done what were the regulations, were they working, were they not working? So if something horrible happens on a smart motorway, the same is going to happen. And I think you need to do much more than you have done already. And the thing they have done is start to put in place far more emergency escape areas. I personally still support them. I ask a lot about the evidence. I still think that motorways and smart motorways and motorways with all lane running are amongst, if not the safest roads in Europe, and that we must not get carried away. There are horrible things that happen. You feel terribly sorry for people whose families are involved in accidents on them. But there are accidents on all roads, and dreadful things happen on the roads. and we need, when it comes to something like decision making around smart motorways, to be cold and rational about what we know about their effectiveness or otherwise. But equally, I think we need to go more than the extra mile to make sure they're safe. And that means having all the emergency kit in place, all the information kit in place, enough emergency refuge areas, et cetera, et cetera. You know, with something like those, you can't just kind of play straight by the book and do just what's necessary. You have to do much more, and that's my point. And as we've seen with the horrendous events, the Grenfell fire, not enough had been done as a precaution against something terrible happening. And I was very clear with Highways England, you need to make sure that the vulnerabilities that could be there with smart motorways are minimised to the maximum possible degree.
Nobody drives along the M25 going, oh, this is an inexpensively widened bit of road that means I'm not sitting in a traffic jam at the moment.
Not enough is done to defend motorways, smart motorways. Using the example already there, I mean, if you drive down the A3 or drive down the A23, these are 70-mile-an-hour, three-lane dual carriageways that don't have hard shoulders. I've never heard anybody complain about the fact I haven't got hard shoulders or argue that the A3 should suddenly have a hard shoulder. But it's a very convenient story to go, oh, smart motorways, awful, when we have got plenty of dual carriageways that are 70-mile-an-hour roads without hard shoulders.
I don't think there was any public engagement at all. I was wheeled out once on the BBC to try and explain smart motorways and got somebody's in the comments on YouTube, I hope you die on a smart motorway, you evil, and I'll stop quoting from now on. And it was shocking, the level of anger and hatred about it. Yep. And it kind of started the same way with speed cameras. Speed mm-hmm. cameras were seen as a war on motorists. It was a terrible mm-hmm. thing. And Jeff Collins here, chairing this meeting, will always say it's not a war on motorists, it's a war on bad driving, which mm-hmm. everyone should fight. And over the years, we've kind of got to a level where people really accept safety cameras now. What was your view of them politically?
So I think when they first arrived, large numbers of motorists not happy about them, not happy about being caught, not happy about the idea that you're being watched and prosecuted. And of course, initially, you didn't know whether they worked or not. I think they're here to stay. I think they are, generally speaking, a good thing. I would not want to see a universal application of average speed cameras. But actually, we're in the situation now where the technology is even moving beyond those, because there are some of the systems which are being developed within the automotive industry, some of the rules in the EU around what has to be put into a car these days. You know, we are going to have speed limiters in all the cars made in Europe. Now, they're not mandatory here, but they will effectively come here because nobody's going to make a different car for the UK than for the rest of Europe. And in a variety of ways, in a sense, almost the technology in speed cameras is going to be superseded by the technology in cars. I think on the whole, speed cameras have been a sensible thing. One of the things that I always find highly amusing is those stories you get, you know, village in the West Country demands a speed camera, people speeding through our village, it's terrible, our children are in danger. So a speed camera gets put in and the people who get caught live in the village. That happens quite regularly. But I think that the truth is there are some areas where I think the war on the motorist is a genuine issue, but I don't actually think the speed cameras are, you know, that's, you know, as long as they're not on every corner, actually, then places where there is a genuine issue around speeding, I think everyone would accept them now.
Whatever happened to the road safety strategy?
So I genuinely don't know the answer to that. What I can tell you, though, is that Whitehall is a slow-moving machine. And there are things that are high on the priority list at a moment in time and things that are not. And it's not that road safety itself is not a priority, but does a road safety strategy in its own right make a transformational difference? It's the individual things that are done. I would be saying that whether you've got a strategy or not, what matters is whether you respond to an issue as it emerges.
Does it frustrate you that Whitehall moves so slowly?
Yes. I mean, I found it frustrating as a minister. I mean, you only get a certain amount of time in your job. You want to make a change, make some changes quickly, and it's often very difficult to do so. What I do know is that unless you have a very determined Secretary of State who wants to drive through a change, it's quite difficult to do anything rapidly. All too often, the minister is a decision point for a department and the person who fronts the show for the department and who carries the can if the department messes up. That's the nature of the job. But the big difference the minister can make is if there is a particular change that is part of a manifesto that one government wants to drive through or is needed as a result of circumstance. The minister is the position, who is the person who's the minister can really drive that. Unless you've got a minister who really is driving, the machine does move very slowly. The problem is, in many respects, there are so many checks and balances for all the right reasons, but those checks and balances slow everything down monumentally. The right and wrong answer on that is quite difficult to find. I mean, should we have a situation where a decision by a Secretary of State has to go around the whole of Whitehall, has to go through officials, has to go to independent bodies for approval? Well, arguably, yes, in order to stop the Secretary of State messing things up monumentally. But boy, does it slow things down.
What's your view on technology to help transport either safer, moving people more efficiently or more sustainably?
So I think moving people more efficiently, sensible. making sure that there is reasonable behaviour, sensible. I think we've got to be very careful, though, not to try and create an environment where we're trying to drive people out of their cars. Many places, many environments, people will now choose to move away from car use. You know, look what's happening in our big cities, where actually huge numbers of young people do not have driving licences, just use an Uber. We will in future eventually get to the point where there's driverless Ubers around the corner and you just call one round. We have car clubs. So we are seeing changes in patterns of behaviour, which I think in big cities are broadly sensible. But, you know, we're relatively close to the city here, but I think the idea that you would try and drive people off the roads in Epsom and Ewell by creating, whether it's the 15-minute city type rules you've got in places like Oxford, whether it is charging that tries to drive people off the roads. And these have real effects. I mean, the introduction of the ULEZ in outer London has had a real effect on many of my constituents, people who now can't afford to go and see relatives who live just up the road because they've got an old diesel car, they can't afford to buy another one, and they're going to get charged £12.50 every time they go. So these things have real impacts. So I think we have to be very careful. I'm all for encouraging changes of behaviour which are prudent, sensible and necessary, but doing so in a punitive way that tries to stop people doing things they need to do, I'm not in favour of.
There's, of course, the elephant in the room that's road user charging.
So I don't think we're going to wake up one morning and have a government white paper saying we're going to introduce a pay per mile on every stretch of road in the UK. What I do think is we're going to see more road user charging. Now, that could be pay per mile for lorries on motorways, for example. It may mean pay per mile in and around urban areas. We already have some road user charging in our urban areas. I think the Treasury is going to have a deep desire to introduce road user charging in order to offset the loss of revenue from electric vehicles. But I'm not convinced it's going to get its way anytime soon because the politics of a national road user charging system are very difficult. And just doing it is very difficult. The technology is certainly there to do it, but you think of the complexity of having systems that record the mileage for every vehicle. Do you have a uniform rate for every vehicle and every road and every time of day? Almost certainly not. So then creating this kind of leviathan of charging structure, monitoring it, issuing the invoices, collecting the money, it is doable in theory, but it's a monumental task and would be extremely politically controversial. So I don't see it happening as a big bang. I see it probably happening as a creep.
When you were Transport Secretary, you'd have your ministers who worked to you, and you'd have your experts, and they might come in and say, we suggest this. And was it your job to kind of give the political and the average man or woman in the streets view on whether it was the right or wrong idea? I mean, I'm just interested in just how decisions actually were made.
So to some extent, that's true. And actually, to be honest, the best example I've got of how you could influence a ministerial decision was not my time at Transport. When I was Employment Minister, I had an email from a woman who said, my daughter is unemployed. She's just been offered a month's work experience at a local law firm. She can't do it because she'll lose her benefits. Isn't that crazy? Well, actually, it is. So we changed the rules so people could do up to 8 weeks of unpaid work experience, after which an awful lot got kept on and stayed in work. Now, that's a small example of how policy can change. At the same time, as a minister, you are surrounded by people saying, do this, do that, do the other. Most of the time, you can't possibly entertain what's being proposed. Sometimes you get a gem of a good idea. One of the myths around Westminster is that we are surrounded by big businesses who have got a sort of evil, insidious influence on government. Actually, the charitable sector, the NGO sector are just as, if not more powerful than the commercial sector in lobbying government. But ideas may come from civil servants, they may come from professionals, they may be part of your own manifesto. But actually, new policy departures are not all that common. It tends to be about adjustments you need to make because of a change in circumstance, because something's happened. Witness me saying, look, we've had a really big, horrible national disaster. Let's make sure we don't have another one on the roads. There's no single answer to that one.
We've got a room full of people who would love to influence government policy. What would your recommendation be for how Max and his team at ITS UK and the members that are sitting in this room could actually influence the decision-making process?
Yeah. Well, so the first thing to say is that don't try and talk to the politicians. It may seem to be an odd thing to say. At the moment, for reasons I don't understand at all, there seems to be quite a lot of interest in the business world in getting to know Labour politicians. But the truth is, actually, having good relations with Labour politicians will have very little impact on the actual decisions government takes. Ministers have no involvement in procurement. They have little involvement in decisions about technology. Generally speaking, this is where what you say is true. A recommendation would come from a civil servant to say, right, we've evaluated these three things. We need this change of the regulations in order to make that happen. Do you agree? But that will come from the civil service and will come from expert panels set up to look at individual issues. It may come from local authority pressure. It may come from outside bodies like the RAC and the AA. Actually, the last people you want to be focusing all your time and effort on are the politicians, because government doesn't work like that. The politician is a figurehead who more often than not is there to sign off what has already been decided, on a big procurement or on the choice of a particular technology.
That's a really fascinating thing. Now, you have been an MP now for 23 years,
yep.
And we've had a rush of elections over the last few years, and we've got another one coming up soon that you're standing down.
Mm-hmm.
What are your plans post-Parliament? Is transport figuring in them at all?
Well, I think the answer to that is actually, I hope so. My plans are to do a variety of things, the classic portfolio. I really do some things. My passions are international conservation, and I'm on the board of an African wildlife charity, and transport, to be frank. And I do work with Hutchison Ports at the moment, and probably look to do some more things in transport if anybody wants me. And I'm also on the board of the National Portrait Gallery, which is very interesting and enjoyable. So my plans are a mix of things, but I hope to carry on doing some things in the transport world, yes.
Are you worried after so long you'll miss it, or is it almost you feeling now a bit demob happy?
I think you know when it's time to change. I think doing something for 23 years, and it's a moment just to change track a bit. And, my generation, we've been around the cycle. We've been through 9 years in opposition. We've been through 13 years in government. And it's just time, it's time for the next generation. I think it's a good idea to know when it is time to move on and not to stay too long. There's a few people at Westminster who have stayed too long, and I think that definitely don't stay too long.
Thank you very much.
That's interesting stuff, especially around not talking to politicians if you want to get stuff done. Chris Grayling, our guest on Highways Voices this week, with thanks to ITS UK for inviting me along to lead the conversation. So you are listening to Highways Voices, where it's time to catch up with our partners.
Highways Voices, with the latest news and events from our partner organisations Elkrig, Adept, the Transport Technology Forum and ITS UK.
The sponsor of this year's Transport Technology Forum conference, Clearview Intelligence, has praised the organisation of the 2024 event, which saw nearly 350 people attend and discuss current and future trends in transport technology. The TTF is co-funded by the Department for Transport and Innovate UK, and the the SME's head of technical sales, Peter Cattell, said the three-day meeting in Leicestershire allowed him and his colleagues in the industry to meet the right people, have the right discussions, and learn plenty of new things as we mark our company's 50th birthday. He added, "This is just what you want from a good conference. It was fantastic." In total, 344 people attended, with more than 250 attending the networking events. 71 local or combined authorities were represented, along with people from Crown Commercial Service, Northern Ireland's Department for Infrastructure, National Highways, Transport Scotland, the Welsh Government, and Transport Infrastructure Ireland. The Department for Transport itself had 13 representatives. Delegates attending this year's Innovation and Learning Festival, hosted by the Local Council Roads Innovation Group, Elcrig, will have the unique opportunity to witness the world's first autonomous pothole repair system in action. Developed by startup company Robotics 3D, a spin-out from the University of Liverpool, this first-of-its-kind robot detects and seals road surface cracks to prevent potholes from forming. A series of updated carbon plenary documents has been published by the Live Labs 2 projects. From the outset, Live Labs 2 set a high bar in terms of how the programme will remove and reduce carbon from the local highways network and evidence those changes. However, measuring carbon for ongoing infrastructure activities is an emerging field, and there's not been a clear consensus on approaches used. So they say we need an agreed, consistent approach in order to measure success. In September 2023, Live Labs 2 held a carbon plenary event exploring how to measure carbon within the programme. It held a second carbon plenary in March 24, where each project updated on activities and findings to date in advance of baselining being published in the summer. And you can view the updated March 2024 carbon plenary on the Adept website. And finally, we've already talked about ITS UK being the place for the main interview on today's podcast. Well, it's welcomed newly elected and re-elected councillors and mayors following the local elections last week, issuing a briefing on the key benefits intelligent transport can provide to communities across the UK. The briefing sets out how local policymakers, through technology, can support a more integrated, safer and efficient transport network for their constituents, providing examples of government initiatives and funding that can support their work.
Highways Voices with Paul Hutton.
So that's just about it, because we've got no Adrian this week, and with no Adrian, there's no Adrian's accolade, but hopefully we'll get that back next week. So that is it for this Highways Voices. We have more to come next week, as I say, and I haven't yet chosen which of a host of fascinating interviews that I've got in the can which one I'm going to use, but I will do by next Wednesday at 9:30, when I can actually promise you it'll be another good one. We'll speak then.
Highways Voices. Join us again next week for more insights from those that matter in the industry.